On this week's Devils in the Details, an uneventful win over Everton, spearheaded by a burgeoning star, gives United faint hopes in the race for Champions League football. We also introduce a new segment where we'll be looking at players who might be candidates to join United's setup next season, with Everton's Amadou Onana leading the list. Case, we said we wouldn't dwell too much on these matches if they didn't produce anything significantly different and new to what we've been seeing all season. Do you feel that this Everton match produced anything that, you know, is worth writing home about?
I would say the short answer to that question is no. This was another match where United had very little match control. Everton had more territory than United did. United get two penalties relatively early in the match, win the match on XG, I think, by about a goal. But when you consider that there were two penalties, Everton actually beat United on open play expected goals. But again, that's a game state thing, not necessarily an indictment of anything in particular. But yeah, not a good performance. Easily could have conceded many goals. Yeah, I think that's the bottom line. I don't know that there's that much new to talk about. It was very similar in style to other matches. We just scored early.
Yeah, I feel like, in general, while the game state considerations definitely exist here in terms of how we should look at Everton's ability to get back into this match from a statistical standpoint, I also feel like conceding 20 shots and 1.5 XG to Everton is not acceptable, even if you're going to sit back and defend the entire match, because you should be able to suppress the shot quality of a team of Everton's quality by a significantly greater margin than that if you want to be a team that's competing at the top half of the Premier League. So
when you say shot quality, you mean ability to get shots off, not shot quality, right?
I mean, yeah, the average shot quality was quite low, but they also had a lot of shots in the box. So I actually mean both shot quality, but then shot quality aggregated over a number of shots. So, you know, both their ability to get shots off in the box and their ability to get off 20 shots. Neither of those should be happening in
defend
games against bottom half teams. Yeah.
Yeah. General statement.
As a whole, though, I mean, United did get the 3 points, and I would attribute that to a large extent to Alejandro Garnacho, who, once again, I mean, he didn't get a goal or assist for either of these goals, but he won both penalties, which were converted by Fernandes and Rashford. How important do you think Garnacho is becoming to this team? I've made the title of this episode Garnacho Carrying, and I mean that in both ways, because he both carried United to the win, and he's also becoming one of the most productive ball carriers in the Premier League, both in terms of volume and progressiveness.
Yeah, I think he's been United's best attacker this season on the balance of, you know, if you take the full season, he's been the most consistent, which is not to say he's been entirely consistent, but I think he's been the most consistent. If you look at the amount of threat he creates when he plays and you look at the numbers, he is a massive outlier amongst players his age. If you go back to when Garnacho broke through from the youth sides, I did not foresee this arc for him. He's been fantastic. Should have scored probably twice yesterday, but those are the kinds of things that you don't kill a 20-year-old for. I have plenty of faith that he'll come around on that. I think people have totally lost sight of exactly how young he is.
He's literally 19.
Yeah, he's not even 20. If this were a functional United side, he wouldn't have been thrust into this role so early, and people would just be excited about how good he is. But because we're forced to rely on him, I think people talk about him like he's 25, and he's 19, and probably the best 19-year-old United have had in a long time. I would say probably in the post-Ferguson era, and I realize that'll be controversial to a lot of people, but
I mean, just to substantiate that claim a little bit, you're looking at a United side that are playing in the Premier League and not even being dominant in the Premier League. This is a team that's not doing well for XG conceded, not doing well for XG put up, not doing well for touches in the box, territory, attacking third touches for their best players. And in spite of all of that, Garnacho is, over the last year, in the 92nd percentile for progressive carries, 98th percentile for penalty area touches, 88th percentile for non-penalty XG, 53rd percentile for expected assists, and 77th percentile then overall for non-penalty expected goals plus expected assisted goals, with 0.53 per 90 across his minutes in the Premier League and Champions League in the last 365 days. Those are ridiculous numbers considering the team he's playing in. It puts him as roughly United's best player alongside Bruno. And I mean, now he's even starting matches. At this time last year, he was putting up ridiculous numbers and we were saying, okay, but can he do this from the start of games?
Yes,
he's
he
doing
can.
It from the start of games.
Yes, he can.
Yeah. This is a huge outlier for his age, but also a very good player in general. And I think it's been a really huge asset because I don't really know what United would have done if they didn't have this player available. I think this season would have been a lot worse.
Yeah, totally agree. The only even comparable season to what Garnacho's having amongst teenagers who've played for United since Ferguson left is Anthony Martial's debut season. And that was in a side that was, relative to the division, far more capable of controlling matches, having territory, getting their attackers on the ball in greater volume in the final third. You could make the argument that United play faster and therefore play in transition more often. So it's a bit of a give and a take there. But I feel like this story has gotten less attention than it probably deserves because he has been fantastic. Yeah, he's been the best teenager in the Premier League this season. I think you can say that pretty confidently. That's a big deal. Yeah. So hats off to Garnacho because he literally did carry in this match. Yeah, I think that's really all I have to say about it. Otherwise, the tactical foundations and trends are the same. If that changes, you'll hear from us, but I don't think we need to beat a dead horse.
All right. I think with that, we can move on to the subjects we have outside this match. Xavi asks, with links to Branthwaite, I'm curious how you envision Martinez's future playing out. Hypothetically, could you see him playing centrally in a back three? Now, I'll be honest, today is the start of a new series that we've been working on and want to bring to you over the next few months, both to make this United team and content around this United team more interesting, but also to lead into the summer and exciting times related to, you know, new board level changes and what types of changes we think the new board is likely to be making on the pitch. And so we're going to be talking about a lot of summer transfers. But I wanted to preface this with United played Everton yesterday, or you guys will be listening to this on a Monday probably, so 2 days ago. Obviously, there have been heavy links to two Everton players, Amadou Onana and Jared Branthwaite. And before we get into this, I think I just wanted to clarify why we will not be talking about Branthwaite just yet until either links get heavier or the new manager is announced. Case, do you want to go into this, or do you want me to maybe explain it further?
No, you go ahead. You go ahead, because I'm not sure exactly what you're going to say.
I mean, the main thing here is I don't think that. So, Case and I have gone into research on seven different positions that in which we think A, United should be signing players, and B, it is interesting for us to scout players in that position. So, for example, we didn't include the possibility that Bayindir will leave, and United will need a backup goalkeeper. Those positions include right back, left back, center back, midfield for two players, a winger, and a striker. And for center back, most of the players that we've been aiming to scout are right-footed. And the idea behind that is both of us envision that it's most likely at this point that United will be playing in a back four next season. And therefore, the center back that United sign will be signed with the view of starting alongside Lisandro Martinez, whom I think is United's best defender and is also the most recent United defender to join and is also the youngest current United center back. Jared Branthwaite, whom, from what I've seen from Everton so far, I've watched a fair bit of Everton this season. I've obviously been watching Onana. Branthwaite is a left-footed center back. He's very good. He's a young player, so I think there's a chance that, you know, this is a player who will be in the frame of big clubs over the next few summers, if not this summer. But he's very expensive, and he's a left-footed center back. And in general, I think I have doubts that he would start alongside Lisandro Martinez, which is what I think United should be aiming to find for next season. It would involve him playing at right center back. Maybe this warrants a search back into his PSV days. And I think that's what we might do in the event that he is linked more heavily or signed, or United hire a manager who plays a back three, in which case Branthwaite could play in the middle of the back three and Lisandro Martinez could play on the left of the back three. But at this point, it feels more, it feels more appropriate to address the Onana links and then give this Branthwaite saga a little more time to develop, because we don't really have anyone else on the list that we're linearly comparing him to. It's all right-footed center backs and players in other positions.
Yeah, I think that's well put. He's a weird fit in the context of what we feel United are looking for, but if it becomes more relevant, we'll talk about him at greater length.
This new topic is our summer transfer series, and we're going to be talking about different players every single week, just as I said. How we've done this, we have a huge list of different players that we've just been going through one by one and watching video. I think a key thing here is, at least as I've been watching it, in case might differ here, I've been watching for specifically players I think would fit in well at United. Once I get an idea that the player does not really fit what United need, I stop watching, regardless of how good I think they might be. I think you'll see examples of players where I'll say, you know, I've watched two or three matches of this player and I just didn't feel that they suited what United need this summer, because they just don't have the basic skill set that we're looking to add in that position based on what we think is missing in the squad. With that being said, that allows us to go through lists of players specifically with this objective in mind. Based on the fact that United played Everton, I think the suitable or the fitting starting point here is to talk about Amadou Onana. United have also had high profile links to Onana. For those of you who don't know, but he plays in the Premier League, so I'm sure almost everyone will know Onana. He is a 6'4 central midfielder born in 2001. He's been playing for Everton. Before that, he joined for a relatively sizable fee of £33 million in 2022. And since then, I think his value has actually gone up, because he's had a lot of very promising performances for Everton and attracted interest from some of the biggest clubs in the Premier League, partially in light of Everton's financial difficulties, partially in light of their relegation battle, but also just because he's very good. And often the Premier League is seen as a proof of concept that players can move from playing for bottom half clubs to playing for top half clubs without having to actually move divisions. We're gonna do this by looking at five questions for every single player. I think we'll start with, for Onana, a clear standout trait is his physicality. We've been emphasizing a lot on the podcast that physicality is a key trait required to play for the top sides these days, and especially something that United have been lacking in midfield. We've seen some physical struggles from Casemiro, definitely seen physical struggles from Christian Eriksen. You know, United have signed Sofyan Amrabat this summer. I think our main hesitancy with the Amrabat signing when he joined was the fact that we weren't sure whether he had the physicality to be a Champions League level midfielder for a Premier League team. Let's start there with Onana. What are some of the physical strengths that he brings to the side, and do you think that those are things that United really need to add in midfield this summer?
It's funny that you brought up Amrabat, because I was actually going to bring him up in this segment in a different context for related reasons. But I'll answer your question first. Yeah, so I think Onana, major set piece threat, obviously aerial threat. He has, I think he's more than capable of doing the ground coverage necessary to play for United. Yeah, I don't think the raw physicals are at all a concern here. I think he's plus. Like, I think he's significantly better than your average Premier League midfielder, basically across the board. He's not slow. Yeah, like I said, strong in the air, just generally strong. I'm not worried about contact here from him, whether on the ball or off the ball. So yeah, I don't think any of that is going to be a problem in terms of the physicals themselves, as opposed to, you know, I think people often associate strength with tackling ability, and those are two different things.
I mean, I don't really know if there's much else to say from a physical standpoint, because I think it's just very obviously a strength of his.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll move into that in terms of, you know, do you think that there are concerns here with his tackling ability, with, you know, his strength in duels, stuff like that? Do you think this is a player who will have high-end performance in duels for a team like United?
Yeah, so I do think he's a plus in duels as well. I think in particular, this is a player who could be valuable when United are forced to go long. Not because I think he's like a specifically a target man, but because I think United have had a lot of trouble with second balls this season. And I think he can aid in that, just being the first to second balls. I think he's capable in duels. I don't think he's like a massive technical standout in duels the way I think like some of the best defensive midfielders in football are particularly good tacklers, but that's not the end of the world, and that's something that can develop also. Yeah, I think bottom line with this question is he is an above average dueler in the Premier League. I don't think he's as massive a standout in duels as he is just in terms of general physicality. Would you agree with that?
I think so. Like, I mean, I don't think he's at the level of, you know, to give examples, someone like Declan Rice or Prime Casemiro, or I'm trying to think of a third example here.
Those are good examples. I don't think we need more than two.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I don't think he's quite at that level yet. And I think in many ways, it can be easy to assume that he is because of his general size. But I also, like you said, I don't think this is a huge problem. I think more so than duels, I think where this United team has been losing out physically in midfield is pressing, ability to really cover high amounts of ground and get to the ball. I think one thing you saw with United in past seasons before this is how much a player like Fred played. I don't think Fred was a robust player in duels at all, to be honest with you. But I think Fred was definitely he was a 90 plus percentile ground coverage player.
Yeah.
And especially in a press, which allowed United to pin opposition more than you would expect relative to his technical ability. So when you think about pinning the opposition, you often think about tempo-oriented midfielders in possession who know when to maintain, know when to progress. That wasn't Fred. But when Fred played, United were able to keep the ball in the opposition half more often because he was able to cover that kind of ground. And I think where maybe you were losing out with a player like Fred was you were losing out on just the pure, you know, height and strength that you get from a peak defensive midfielder. So he couldn't really play at number six. There were also issues with his positional discipline in that role, but those felt in the context of a 23-year-old, those issues can feel more coachable than, you know, are you big enough? Are you strong enough to handle one-on-ones against the best wingers and the best forwards in Europe? Because that's something that defensive midfielders can face in the Premier League. But I think since Fred has left, you've lost a lot of that
ground coverage.
That ability.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree. I totally agree with what you're saying here. Because I think we talked about this. United's press has been so stratified this season that it's not the entirely the fault of the players. But I also think players like Kobbie Mainoo, Bruno Fernandes, Casemiro at this point in his career, Eriksen, Amrabat, these are not, I think they're at best like league average, maybe I think probably league average for midfielders, some of them below, for their ability to cover ground. And that's not just like a sprint speed thing. That's a stamina thing and a sprint speed thing. It's your ability to, you know, make mid-level and high-intensity runs consistently throughout a match at the same speed as other talented, very physically gifted footballers are doing them. And I think that exacerbates what is a poorly conceived press. And I think bottom line here is Onana would not be a problem with that. And in that way, I think he would be a real upgrade for United. I think the next question, though, is in the context of technical competencies, do you think he is the right technical profile to play as the deepest midfielder in midfield for United? And if not, why? Is it because he doesn't have certain attributes or because you think he's used differently? I'll let you take that.
Yeah, so we had a question from someone named Maroney who asked, how important is it to look at team style when assessing transfers? Onana and Branthwaite are linked, but Everton's style doesn't match how you expect United to play. Are you just trusting their skill set that they can adapt to building up from the back under pressure? And obviously, Sean Dyche has been Everton's coach for this season and much of last season. And before that, when Onana first joined, it was Frank Lampard. And I actually think this is an interesting question in the context of what we were talking about a few minutes ago, because Lampard in particular used Onana as a long ball outlet in big matches to allow Everton to actually try and beat pressure against some of the best pressing sides in the Premier League. And in that sense, I actually think that that's something that could be very useful to United in the medium to long term. I think a lot of big teams are beginning to look at having players who can be an out ball. And when you're looking at the side you're building, I think Rasmus Højlund has shown that he can do it to some extent. I think he can develop in that area and be a good player, at least from a physical standpoint. I don't think you have many other players in this United side who are going to be long ball outlets from goal kicks, unless you're looking to be starting Scott McTominay in the long term, which that's something both Case and I have said we don't really think is an option. So in that sense, Everton's playing style actually really helps us get an idea of what Onana can do. Everton also press high in certain phases of the game. One ways in which Dyche teams actually look to manufacture chances is by forcing transitions when the opposition are playing out in certain phases. That's something that's not really known about his teams, because essentially I would say that he knows that the defensive methods that are required in his game model to get the results that his Burnley team and now his Everton team have produced from a defensive standpoint require certain attacking compromises in a settled sense of being able to commit high amounts of numbers up top in settled possession phases. So you won't see Dyche teams have, you know, possession for 3 minutes of a match and commit tons of players forward and then get beat easily on the counter in, and I would say that's particularly true in even states, because you might look at Saturday's match and say, you know, United had tons of space to play on the counter and we're able to do that. But I think a big component of that was Everton already being losing the game.
So can you say what you were saying there from the beginning again? Because I've kind of lost track of what you were initially saying.
Okay.
Sorry, I don't mean to be annoying.
No. I think that's fair. I think this is a long idea. So looking at team style, Dyche is obviously very different to the types of coaches we are looking at for United. I think certain aspects of how Dyche, and before him Lampard, have used players like Onana add credence to his ability to do certain jobs in midfield for United, such as, I think it has been shown that Onana can be successful in a high press. I think it has been shown that he can be a long ball outlet. However, I think from a technical standpoint, we really don't have that much evidence that Onana is a player who can help United play out of the back, playing through other teams by keeping the ball on the ground, getting progressive center backs who play the ball into the feet of central midfielders on the half turn and rely on them being able to turn and progress the ball out of high pressure scenarios. I think this is where one thing you'll see us do a lot is say, what do we know for sure is likely? And is that enough? And then what do we think could be possible? So in the case of Onana, I think I've seen very few examples of him crumbling under pressure, because regardless of whether teams play through pressure, midfielders in the Premier League still experience pressure. You heard us going after Romeo Lavia last season in a team that didn't necessarily play through opposition all the time. That was because of his ability to resist pressure. I think you see, not necessarily to Lavia's level, but I think you see Onana's ability to resist pressure and retain possession on a consistent basis from what we've seen of him in the Premier League. I don't think that the major problem that you could have with Onana is that he's going to be unable to receive possession and reliably keep the ball. I have questions about his ability to receive possession and progress the ball in high pressure scenarios at high rates relative to other Premier League midfielders playing for Champions League level teams. This was a similar concern to something I had about someone like Declan Rice when he was playing for West Ham, but I think Rice was actually, I would say, better than Onana in this area. I think here's what it comes down to. What you're going to do is you're going to pair Onana with a midfielder like Kobbie Mainoo, or I personally think United should be signing an alternative to Kobbie Mainoo this summer, because you can't just have Mainoo for every single match this season. And when he's out, you're going to need someone else who can do what he does. Alternatively, you can even sign someone to start and do what Kobbie Mainoo does and then slowly integrate him into the team in the next few years, which I think might actually be my preferred option. But nonetheless, United are going to have this press-resistant, ball-carrying, high-passing-range defensive midfielder next to him. What other teams might try and do is mark that player out of the game and funnel the ball into someone like Amadou Onana, and then therefore reduce United's efficiency when being able to play through opposition and playing out of the back scenarios. I think in that scenario, whether Onana is a good Premier League player or one of the best players in midfield, in the Premier League, in Europe, is going to depend on how progressive he can be in those scenarios. I don't think it's likely that he's going to be extremely progressive, to be honest with you. I don't think that this is a player who's going to be one of the best in the Premier League at these playing out of the back scenarios, but I don't think that necessarily means United shouldn't sign him. I have other reasons for saying that I think we'll get to later on. Is there anything you maybe want to add here?
I think you've basically hit the key points for me. I'll just reiterate something that you already touched on, which is when we talk about these players in the coming weeks and months, I think a key thing to remember is Aaron and I both feel pretty strongly that you sign a player on the basis of what you know they can do, with the hopes that you can develop new things, but not with the expectation. You don't build conjecture into a transfer fee. Like, you could say about Onana, oh, he could develop into a very press-resistant progressive passer in deeper areas. But you don't buy him assuming that he will. Because if you build a team, again, on conjecture, you wind up with a team that can't do any of the things that you need them to do. With that in mind, it's not that I don't think Onana can do it. It's that we don't have, like you said, overwhelming evidence that he can. And those are two different things, right? But I think when you're talking about spending tons of money on a player and reportedly have a limited budget, you've got to be pretty vicious in terms of your assessment of their weaknesses, I think. So I think that takes us to our next question, sort of.
Yeah, I mean, I think a great example of this is, you know, if you look back at our episodes when Hoyland signed, I think there were aspects of striker play in which we said, you know, Atalanta is just a very different team to United. We tried to watch matches of the Danish national team to get an idea of what types of striker movement Hoyland actually has available that he'll be able to perform at United as a lone striker. But I don't think we really had conclusive evidence. And that was a big question mark that we had about the signing, because if his movement was static against the block, I really think this would have been a miserable season for United. I think luckily we've seen that Hoyland has some level of physical movement against a block, and also I'd say a high level for his age, which has made me feel a lot more assured about the Hoyland signing. And maybe that was something that United scouts are able to project better than I am, but I honestly felt it was just a big area of risk that United were taking in assuming that, you know, he has the physical traits, he has the technical traits, he will be able to adapt mentally to moving like that when tasked with playing up front for a Premier League team as a lone striker. And I think it would be the same thing about talking about Onana playing out of the back. He plays for a team that's just tactically fundamentally different to what United do right now, and or what United will look to do next season. And therefore, it becomes really hard to project, but I don't think it's necessarily likely that he's going to become this overtly progressive passer and dribbler and, you know, become the next, I don't know, what we think Mainoo could be at this particular area of the game. Now, yeah, let's move to the ceiling and floor of the signing. What do you think, Case, is the best outcome for this signing? What do you think is, you know, the worst outcome for the signing? And I'm going to say barring injuries, because obviously the worst outcome is the player just gets injured and then they can't play. But barring that, which I think is a difficult thing for us to forecast, how well do you think signing Amadou Onana could go? How poorly do you think signing Amadou Onana could go?
Okay, so keep in mind when I'm answering this question, I'm answering ceiling or best case scenario as like 95th percentile outcome as opposed to 99th, and floor as 5th percentile as opposed to 1st. And the reason I say that is with players who are young to a certain extent, they can develop skills that are totally unforeseeable. And those things are very difficult to foresee, and I'm not going to try to foresee them. I'm not going to say, like, Onana's best outcome is the best midfielder in the world because he's got these physical tools, and if he just develops technically, he could be the best. I don't think that's true. Semantically, it is. Like, it could happen, but I think the real likely outcome, like the top-end outcome for Onana, is that you wind up with a midfielder with elite physical impact, both in your own box, in the opposition box, and between the boxes, who gets by in possession, which is to say he's not your primary means for progressing the ball. He's probably not your secondary means for progressing the ball. But if he's put in a position where the opposition says, we're going to prevent everyone else from beating us, and Onana is going to be the player who moves the ball down the pitch, he can capably do that. And I think that is your best outcome. And I don't think it's implausible. I think it's, I think in that instance, you wind up with him being one of the best players in the Premier League. I think we've seen Rice, for example. I think that's sort of what Rice is. Declan Rice is not this super high volume progressive passer. First phase is still not his great strength, but what he can do is he can carry the ball in space. He has the he can use his physicality to shed off contact when on the ball, and Arsenal aren't crippled when they're forced to play through him. Yeah, so I think that his ceiling is sort of something very similar to Rice, maybe with a slightly different stylistic tilt. Like, I think I think maybe, well, it's tough to say because I think some people feel Rice is better used higher up the pitch, but I think Onana perhaps is the kind of player who you actually push forward and sort of use him for his defensive impact out of possession, and then his role in possession is something quite different from what you'd imagine from a defensive midfielder. But anyway, that's all not related necessarily to ceiling. As for floor, I think the floor here is you wind up with a player who isn't technically adventurous enough under pressure to be usable in big matches. And that's not to say that I think he's a bad technician, but players who haven't played in roles that demand them be an outlet when being pressed high frequently. And when I say an outlet, I mean like coming short to the ball with a man on your back, turning them, passing forward. Those players often wind up being very regressive with their passing in those phases, and ultimately that leads to ball losses typically. And so I think that's sort of like your bad outcome where he and the other side of this floor being he's not a 95th percentile athlete in the Premier League. He's a 75th percentile athlete, which is just going to provide you with significantly less impact. And I think that's like the absolute floor. But I'll be honest, I think you're guaranteed here a few valuable attributes, which is what makes him enticing, I think, more than his ceiling. I think that the floor is pretty high.
Yeah, I pretty much agree. I think you're getting a player who has... One thing we've talked about, you know, is players who have outsized impact in particular traits. And I think in Onana, you have that. I think in a lot of the players we're going to suggest United to sign this summer, you have that. A player who, you know, even if he doesn't become a progressive passer and progressive carrier, you're getting such outsized defensive impact that... And such outsized physicality in attacking scenarios. You're improving your ability at set pieces. You're improving your ability to go long from the goalkeeper. I think those things are relative guarantees with Onana. For at least 5 or 6 seasons, you're going to get elite physicality. You're going to get... I think it's relatively unlikely that he's, you know, as poor under pressure as someone like Casemiro, based on what we've seen. I think... you're likely to get someone who's better than that. And if he can keep the ball in any scenario on the pitch and have huge defensive impact and good attacking impact, that's a good Premier League player for, you know, as long as he is in that physical peak that he's in. So I think my low-end scenario would be, yeah, he doesn't end up being a starter for United long-term, but he becomes tactical enablement for... you know, certain scenarios in matches, certain types of opposition. He becomes valuable cover when, you know, perhaps in a few years, if you replace him with another midfielder, that midfielder gets injured and you're lacking physicality in your midfield. I think Onana will be a player who's good enough to step in. And yeah, I think the best case scenario is that you get more out of him on the ball than you're getting at Everton. And in that case, he's probably good enough to be a starter for a title winning team. I don't think he will be one of the best players on that title-winning team, but I think he'd be good enough to start and the sort of player who can enable those better players to actually play at their best in a way that they might not be able to without them.
Yeah, which sort of brings us into our last question, which is, would you sign him and under what circumstances?
Yeah, so I think you actually alluded to something really interesting about how you might use him higher up in possession and then as a more traditional defensive midfielder out of possession, which A, is a role that's reliant on his ability to track back really quickly, which I think he has. And then B, I think kind of alludes to a double pivot where you have, you know, another defensive midfielder who he's going to play alongside, who's going to drop into deep buildup when United are in possession. I think right now the most obvious example and most likely scenario is that midfielder would be Kobbie Mainoo. I guess my would I sign Onana under what circumstances? I think United need 2 midfielders this summer. And I think one of them needs to be an extremely press-resistant, extremely able, ball-carrying progressive passing midfielder, someone who can really take the build-up yards. And I know that there's a lot of optimism about Mainoo. I don't think Mainoo's playing at that level yet for the team that we aspire to be, and I think that's fine. He's a teenager. I don't think you want to look to play him 60 matches a season in the ways we've seen, you know, players like Pedri, Mason Mount, other youngsters in big European teams who have been found to have these traits that these big teams need, and then overplayed because the teams need them, and then they reach their early mid-20s and they're struggling for fitness. I really think United need to be careful of how they manage Mainoo. So all of that is to say, I think United are going to sign another midfielder this summer, and I think odds are, based on the availability of players who emulate someone like Rodri, who is physically massive and also technically massive, I don't really think that's a likely outcome. I think United are likely to get someone who is either short or a little bit slower. And I think you're going to need a kind of balancing player to come in and complement the likes of, you know, Mainoo, that newer, less physical, more technical midfielder, Mason Mount, Bruno Fernandes. If that's the scenario, I think I would be quite happy with signing Amadou Onana. And I think that even if his utility to the team didn't last as a starter when United got better, I think he would still be a very useful player and therefore justify the signing. If United are going to sign him alongside another physical defensive midfielder, I wouldn't really bother. I would sign whichever of the two is the better player, which I think we'll get to explore in upcoming weeks and months as and when United are linked to more defensive midfielders, or we simply find players that we really want to see. I don't think it's impossible that we find a physical midfielder who we feel could be better than Onana as we watch more players in more leagues. But I do think it's relatively unlikely, unless you're going for the press-resistant, in-possession, strengths kind of mold. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it makes sense. And I'll take what you're saying a step further. I think he's a player I would like at United. However, I don't think the likelihood that he achieves his ceiling makes me feel that he should be a primary target. I just don't think this is the summer to be going for players who you think maybe aren't going to be in the starting 11 in 3 years. And that's not to say that I think Onana has no chance of being in the starting 11 in 3 years, but I just don't think he definitely shouldn't be a top priority. There are other, your top priorities should be players that you are absolutely convinced are going to be high impact stars. And I'm not positive he's going to be a high impact star. It's not that I don't think he can be. I don't have that level of certainty that I have had in the past with other players.
Yeah, I'll say this. I think one defense of signing him anyways would be it's very easy to sign, you know, these top level stars and then not set them up in circumstances with exactly. And then those top level stars fail, and then there's turmoil and internal and external doubt about whether that was the right signing to make. And my favorite example of this is always Paul Pogba, a player who I think was indisputably elite in many ways when he joined United, but also needed other midfielders who carried out many of the fundamental aspects of deep buildup and defensive stability that Pogba didn't really offer, at least didn't really offer at an elite level. And I don't think United failed to, I don't think United were able to do that. And then I think it put a burden on Paul Pogba to be a player that he wasn't, and then largely limited his ceiling as a player. And I think my worry is that, you know, I've seen two or three players who I think are, you know, absolutely players United should be going for this summer at all costs, well, at most costs, and should be making top targets. But I do fear that some of those players would struggle playing in the current circumstances that they would arrive into at United just because of the lack of options around them to enable them to play at their best. And I think that Onana could be the type of player who enables some of those players to play better. And again, if that's the case, I would honestly just sign him. And if it doesn't end up that he is in 3 years in the starting 11, I wouldn't be terribly upset about it as long as he's good enough to be a valuable contributor and a rotation member of this team. And there was one more thing I wanted to say. I don't remember. Oh, yeah. But to your point, if, you know, I just mentioned that there are a few players that I would really, really like United to sign. If City or Liverpool or Arsenal or Chelsea signed those players, I would be terrified and disappointed, and it would bother me because I think they're in very low quantity. If City or Liverpool or Arsenal or Chelsea signed Amadou Onana, I would be somewhat disappointed, but I wouldn't be worried that this team would not have players as good as Onana in the future, because I don't think that he's in that absolute top bracket first choice signing that United should be targeting this summer. So I think I agree with you in overall.
Yeah. This is a bit of a nitpick, but I would say I think the Pogba situation was a lot more complicated than just having the right players around him. Or maybe it was actually a lot simpler. I think Pogba should have just played higher up the pitch, and it wouldn't have mattered so much who was around him. I think the who he was surrounded with was more an issue because he was asked to do things that he wasn't meant to be doing. But anyway,
but that feels like somewhat of an that does feel like somewhat of an inevitability, though. If you don't have, like, if you, you know, let's say your midfield is Mainoo, Mount, Bruno, and then, you know, a non-physical fourth central midfielder who's really good in build up, you're going to see Mainoo and whoever that midfielder is taking up a lot of defensive responsibility, and they're going to be put into scenarios where they make mistakes and aren't high impact enough to really stand out.
Yeah, but I'm saying the Pogba situation was different in that he wasn't meant to be in a pivot to
begin. He was also used wrong. Yeah.
But yeah, I take your point. When you don't have a certain profile, you ask other players to fit that profile. And that can be problematic. Anyway, I think we've covered Onana. Yeah, we've got a whole list of players to cover after this. We spent half an hour on Amadou and Onana, which was not in the plans. So yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed this. I hope you guys have questions. Yeah, we're gonna keep doing this going forward. So
great. Yeah, I mean, even though we spent half an hour on Onana, I do feel like a lot of that was about general United signing and principles that we discuss as a whole. So
okay,
let's do one or two questions here before we wrap up. Yeah, all right. Hamza asks, you talk about finding a manager that can implement the tactical traits of a top side. What are the chances that those traits change in the next few years, and should we be looking for someone who can lead that change, even if it would be incredibly difficult?
Yeah, so I like this question. I think the simple answer to this is yes, you should be looking for a manager who maybe is leading some major tactical change, with the caveat being, I think, you know, the other part of the question is, what are the odds of that happening in the next few years? I think they're very low. I don't think the way top sides play shifts as drastically as it has in the last 10 years, every 10 years. I think possession play for top sides is for the most part here to stay. But I mean possession play more specifically in the context of possession play accompanied with an aggressive out of possession approach. All of which is to say, you definitely should be looking for these managers, because when they do come along, they completely revolutionize the game. And to have them means that you can have these crazy dominant periods like what Pep Guardiola's Manchester City has had, and what Barcelona had before with him. But ultimately, I think usually there just aren't managers like that in the game. Like, the game doesn't get revolutionized every 10 years, like I said. And so there are usually periods where the best managers in the game aren't like completely revolutionizing it. They're just understanding how the game is working in a given era and exploiting how the game works. So I think really what you're looking more, what's more important, because it's more probable, is to look for somebody who has an effective game model in the context of the modern sport. But if you can find somebody who's going to change the sport, that's obviously way better. And yes, like, you should have your eye out for that. I think I was expecting Aaron to jump in here, but he did not. The thing I would add to that, though, is we got another question a few weeks ago asking, basically, like, do you think you can beat Pep Guardiola's Manchester City consistently playing the same way that he plays? And I think the answer to that is no. I don't think you're going to find a manager who can execute at a higher level and players as good as Manchester City has during the period that Pep is at Manchester City. So you do need to take a different approach to the game, but I think you still need to fundamentally understand how the game is working right now, which is dominant sides are playing with the ball, and when they don't have the ball, they're playing in the opposition half, before you can start to tweak that and have a different approach that maybe, as Aaron and I have talked about many times, gives you a higher variance of outcomes that allows you to catch City every once in a while. And yeah, maybe whether that's, you know, an increased risk appetite or, you know, a different way of recruiting players, there's a lot of different manifestations of that there could be. But it's a good question yeah. Because we talk so much about using City as a model, but it's not about imitating everything City do. It's about taking the effective things City do and then tweaking them to your own circumstances.
Yeah, you won't see us necessarily suggesting that United use, you know, center backs at fullback have them invert into midfield and then have those players have specific tasks and build up to accommodate other players. Like, a lot of what City do is, you know, A, customizations to the specific talent that they have, such as Haaland and De Bruyne, and B, customizations to the general characteristics of their squad. Largely what they do is just recruit players who are very, very good and then adapt their football to meet the modern trends in a configuration that allows all of their players to play at their best. And that's what great coaches do, ultimately. Like, I think the difference between a good coach and a great coach at this level is those who can take elite talent and embed it with elite talent usually comes with some kind of compromise and embed that elite talent into a side that still tactically works, but allows that elite talent to also function within the side and therefore propel it to a higher level. And I think that's what you're going to see as the question, you know, like I don't think, for example, a team like Liverpool this season is tactically at the level of teams like Arsenal, and obviously City, but I do think that Liverpool have found a way to bring, to put forward a system that gets the best out of their best players who are among the best in the world, and then also effectively build up and effectively press high in most scenarios. And I think that the combination of those two things makes them a bona fide title contender, regardless of, you know, the tactical specifics of how Klopp achieves that and how Liverpool look to assert themselves on games from a micro tactical adjustment standpoint. I really think that's something that we're going to be focusing on a lot, right? And bringing it back to the context of like a coach who can adapt and innovate, you want, like, ideally, and this is what happens with coaches, like a great example of this is Jose Mourinho, right? There was a time when what Jose Mourinho did on a football pitch was tactically innovative and was highly effective. But when it came to the part of football where it developed towards playing out of the back and pressing high with complicated, physically aggressive pressing structures, I don't think Mourinho was able to achieve that. And I think that that explains much of his performance at clubs in the late 2010s and early 2020s. There was a time when he was able, maybe, in certain aspects to compete with Pep. But then I think Pep just continued to evolve and continued to define trends, and Mourinho could not adapt to them. And that doesn't mean that a club shouldn't have hired Mourinho in 2005. I don't think either of us are suggesting that.
I mean, no, I think it's the opposite. I think exactly what you're looking for is somebody like Mourinho, not in his style of play or his behavior, but somebody who in the mid-2000s had a fantastic understanding of how the game was played and exploited it for as long as the game was played that way. But it changed while he was in management, and I don't think that's necessarily any fault of his. It's just not everyone can be the person that changes the game, right? Like, I think it's, if anything, it's an argument in favor of Mourinho's legacy, which is an odd thing to hear from us.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think we'll say a few things on this. Like, one, yeah, it would be nice to have a manager who writes the trends or creates new trends. B, I think that's relatively unlikely. And the most important thing is to have a manager who can get you where you want to be over the medium term horizon, you know, 4 or 5 seasons. Three, I think what you said about variance is a very interesting thing.
We talk about this one, all the time.
Yeah. You know, getting to the second best or the third best or to a point where the error bars are big enough for you to win the Premier League, and then exploiting those error bars to give you a chance to win the Premier League while also maintaining a lowest outcome that is still acceptable for the team. I think that's like a thing that Liverpool do that is very smart and an underrated aspect of why sometimes they have 90-point seasons and sometimes they have 75-point seasons or 72-point seasons. Now, many will argue, you know, Liverpool also had tons of injuries in those seasons. And yes, obviously, that's also a factor. But I think it is also the way they play. I don't think they establish, you know, as much of a variance minimizing, allowing other teams to come into matches and possibly steal points off them in consecutive matches in a way that shows up in a 6 to 8 point difference on a league table at the end of the season. Whereas I think Arsenal are likely, under Arteta, as long as they're in this groove, to be a very consistent team season on season. But I think they're going to be more reliant on actually being the best team in the league, which many will argue they have in this season. But they're going to be reliant on being the actual best team in the league in that season, playing the best football, creating the biggest margins over 38 matches in order to win the league. Which isn't inherently a bad thing. Like, if they're aiming to be the best and they are the best, then they achieved the outcome that they desired. But I think the point that we're trying to make is that we feel that that's a relatively unlikely scenario against Manchester City, the way they play, the players they have, the coach they have. And what's more likely is you're going to end up being the second best team in the Premier League, and there aren't actually that many scenarios in which that plays out in a way that you actually beat the best team in the league to a trophy, in a way that it almost has for Liverpool 3 or 4 times now. No, I mean, all of that is mostly speculative, right? Like, Arsenal might go and win the league this season and then therefore give credence to the idea that maybe you can build a team that's better than City. Because I think if you look at, at least superficially in the metrics, they've been a better team than City this season. And I think it has to do with City maybe having a down year. I think it has to do with Arsenal being a tactically more coherent side than Liverpool at this stage. And I think it opens up some interesting debate about many of the things that we talk about and many of the ideas that we push or, you know, project on this podcast. But I still ultimately believe that it's very hard to build a team that's better than City over 4 or 5 seasons until I see evidence otherwise.
Yeah.
And I think that the model Liverpool has will win more trophies than the model Arsenal has, but I'm not actually sure.
Yeah, but anyway, we've gotten pretty far away from the question, which so to wrap this up neatly, I think it's very unlikely that the broad strokes of the tactical traits that make a top side change in the next few years. If they do, you absolutely have to keep your eye out for it, but I think the more important thing is adapt to your circumstances in the context of the game as it is right now. Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you for the question, Hamza. Hamza's actually the brother of a close friend of mine. So shout out to Hamza. Hope you're enjoying the pod.
We'll do one more question here, just because a lot of people asked about it. Chao Zhao asks, please correct me if I didn't pronounce your name right there. What do you think of Rashford's future here, and should new leadership sell him? I don't think this is actually a topic that Case and I think or talk about a lot, because Rashford's just been a relative mainstay in the team for 4 or 5 seasons now. But a lot of people are talking about it now. I think it comes in light of, you know, links to wingers, perhaps a lack of right wingers prompting more links to left wingers. Garnacho's form, Hoyland's form, and then also the fact that the team's getting a lot younger, and Rashford's actually probably one of the older players who would be on the list of players who are good enough in the current United squad to be a part of the long-term future. And I think the combination of those things, as well as his form this season being quite subpar, brings this into a semi-legitimate conversation where you debate, if a team were to come in with a huge offer for Rashford, would you accept it? Case, what do you think?
I think you definitely should not be guaranteeing Rashford a spot at left wing going forward. But that's not because of anything he's done this season. That's just more, I have felt for a very long time that his true level as a player is probably at best the third best forward in a front three on a title winning side. And so I think you can upgrade on him. And I think it's at left wing, you kind of, it's tough for that, for your left winger to be your third best attacker if you're trying to win a title, just because most of the best attackers in the world are left wingers. There's just the concentration of talent at left wing is much higher than it is at right wing, for sure. And I think arguably is higher than it is at center forward. It's a pretty close split. Just as a product of the fact that right-footed left wingers, there are more of them than there are. There are more right-footed footballers in the world than there are left-footed footballers. And so you're necessarily going to have more talented right-footed footballers than you will left-footed footballers. And so you're going to have a selection bias at right wing. That's going to mean that the average talent level is lower because they have these functional advantages as a product of being left-footed, right? Which is all to say, gets pretty far away from the question about Rashford, but I think there are better left-wingers in the world than Rashford who are accessible, and I would not be shy about going after them if they were available. But I also think Rashford is good enough to play for United and is a homegrown player and really wants to be here. I also don't think he's some cash cow. Like, I don't think you're going to sell him for $100 million. I think you keep him, you make him compete for his position. That's my stance on it.
Yeah, I basically agree. I wouldn't sell Rashford. I think while there may be better left wingers in football than him, and while it might be possible to get them this summer, I think it's unlikely you're going to have four wingers who are better than Rashford at any point in a single squad. I think if you look at pretty much every 20-man squad in Europe with four wingers, Rashford will get into all but like maybe one, maybe, of them. I think he would get meaningful minutes at any team. I don't think that means he should be guaranteed a starting spot next season. I think what would be nice is for United to, at this stage, sign the best winger possible on either flank, and then start players on merit, and leverage the fact that fast wingers score at higher rates when they come off the bench at the like 60th, 65th minute. This is something that hasn't been leveraged enough this season. Like, last season, United got so many points off Garnacho coming off the bench at the 65th minute and just wrecking teams that were either trying to get a goal, trying to get back into games, and just putting the game to bed. And it might actually be nice to have three wingers who are really good.
Yes, totally agree. But this is the part of the reason we haven't been able to leverage this season is that we haven't been leading very often.
Well, that too, but I also don't think United have a winger who could do it, because agreed. I think Rashford and Garnacho have been the only wingers who have been good enough to play minutes. But it's so useful if you're ahead, if you're behind, in any, pretty much in any game state, to tire out defenders with two good wingers for 65 minutes and then bring on a third equally good or better, equally fast, equally penetrative player who can change games. I think that says two things about Rashford. One, it says that I think giving him this spot on the left wing and then not preparing for the scenario in which you need to change it up, or, you know, he gets injured and you have to introduce something else to the team would be a mistake. But I think that getting another winger could actually lead to getting even more out of Rashford and getting even more out of all those other players. That's how City do it. That's also how Arsenal have been doing it. If you look at City and Arsenal's bench players, they've got double figures this season. Like, Leandro Trossard is a player who I don't think is as good as Rashford, and he has close to double figures or double figures in all competitions, close to double figures in the Premier League. Julian Alvarez is a player who wouldn't even start for City if, you know, De Bruyne was fit the whole season. And he has close to 30 goal involvements in all competitions.
Yeah.
Like,
Alvarez is maybe an outlier in that he's insanely good and not necessarily a starter, but
sure. But again, these are the teams you're going to be competing with.
Yeah.
I think people have to get out of this idea of having 11 players who are excellent and rolling them out 60 times a season, because it's just not what the best teams are doing anymore. They are managing the minutes of all of their players and acquiring more players who can play in the event that their very best players are absent. So all of that is to say, I think Rashford still has a lot to offer at United. I would not sell him. I also think that maybe some competition on the wing would be healthy next season. And we're going to talk about players who can come in at left wing and right wing, and be impactful next season.
Yeah. All right. Do we want to wrap it up, or do we want to do another question?
I think we can call it there. We can save some of these questions for next week.
Yeah, agreed. We got some other good questions that we'll come back to next week. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this. This is Aaron and I weren't sure what we were going to talk about today, but I think we actually covered some interesting stuff. Hopefully you guys thought so too. We'll talk next week.
Sounds great. We'll see you next week, everybody. Hope you enjoyed this week's Devils in the Details. You can follow us at DevilsITDPod on Twitter or on a variety of streaming platforms. Our awesome theme music was made by Jacob Connor. You can find at Jacob J. Connor on Twitter. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.